This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Okay, so it's time for another chat here with one of our fine books of the year conversations. Matt's in place. I think he's in a slightly, I can actually see what you look like, Matt, as opposed to...
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And the loft is, that's where I am. So I've decided to change location, given that the last time we did this, my Wi-Fi cut out. So, you know.
There you go. As it has just done. As soon as you started
speaking... Oh, you're kidding.
The picture disappeared, and John Boyne, who's sitting there in his luxury apartment, is thinking, well, I can see Simon Matt, as ever, disappearing because the picture quality is so rubbish. Anyway, all that matters is we can hear John Boyne, who hopefully is feeling very patient and at one with the world. Hello, John.
Hi, Simon. Good to talk to you again.
How are you, sir?
I'm very well. I'm very well. You know, it's been 18 months sitting in this house, but I'm feeling good.
Have you found it, and I don't know, I speak to, authors on this podcast with Matt and actors and directors on the film podcast that I do, and some creative people, for want of a better word, have found it okay, really, being alone with themselves and coming up with ideas, and some have found it a real struggle. Where are you on that sliding scale?
I think I've mostly found it okay. Certainly at the start, I felt it was almost a relief to get a break, you know, from all the like the traveling that goes with book tours and festivals and so on that I'd been sort of doing for about 20 years. And it was quite nice to just be at home and be able to read and be able to write and not have anything on the schedule. I think as time went on, you get a little bit lonelier. And, you know, now that the festivals are starting to kick back in, I'm really looking forward to being, you know, with readers again and being on a stage again and talking about books again. It's the last time was in Adelaide in March of 2020. And I can remember reading about COVID while I was there and thinking, this seems to be turning into something, but not really thinking it was going to turn into something. And, you know, that was 15, 16 months ago.
Yeah. I had a book out last summer, and obviously, like all the other books, the one thing that you can't do is meet other readers. You can't go to the book festivals, and that's a really strange thing. Do you think you'll be happy sitting in front of a desk with a long queue of people from all over, all wanting to come and have a selfie with you and to say hi? Do you think we're back in that kind of normal? How does it feel for you?
For me, yeah, I'm completely happy with it. I've got my vaccinations, I've always felt along the way that I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor. So whatever they tell me I can do, I will do. And if they say it's safe to do that, then I'm happy to do it. As long as people are asking for signatures or selfies and not sort of coming up to punch me in the face. Which, after reading this book, who knows?
Yeah. I have to say, I mean, obviously we're edging into the territory for the Echo Chamber, which is your book. The fact that you're not a qualified doctor or epidemiologist doesn't mean a thing, mate. You can still pronounce on everything, regardless of whether you have any qualifications for it. Just go ahead, knock yourself out.
Well, that's true. People do it all the time and apparently are all experts. And what I find funny is the way that we, you know, I'm sure you do it. I do it like with friends where I say, so what did you get? Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson. And they tell you and you go, oh, right, okay. And really, I haven't even a clue why I asked that question or, you know, what the answer is supposed to mean to me, because I don't really know.
I'm in a mixed marriage. I'm Pfizer and my other half is AstraZeneca, you know, so it's...
Okay. I was Moderna.
Oh, real Moderna. Okay, Matt, what are you?
I'm I'm AstraZeneca, and so is my wife, as they say in Life and Brian.
Well, anyway, so we've edged into social media and we've edged into expertise, and so we're into The Echo Chamber, which is the new book from John Boyne. And fingers crossed, Matt, just describe the cover, please.
okay, here's hoping. I'll keep it tight. So the cover is sort of split, the background between sort of three colours. You've got red on the bottom and then blue and green on the top. But dominating it is the picture of a tortoise with an iPhone strapped to its back. And that's going to be the image that jumps out to you from the book stand. And then obviously picked out in white, the echo chamber. We all make mistakes, don't we? And John Boyne's name at the bottom.
So, John, the last time you were on the on this pod, it was for My Brother's Name is Jessica. And in a and if people didn't hear that, they can go back to where they got this podcast, and they should listen to that podcast first as a kind of a primer for where, because even though the stories aren't connected, they kind of are. Just tell us how you ended up with the Echo Chamber and why you wrote it and what the connection is with My Brother's Name is Jessica.
Yeah, I've never actually written a sequel to any of my books, but in some weird way, one could possibly describe this as such. As you mentioned, I wrote My Brother's Name is Jessica a few years ago, and it was a young adult novel about a trans teenager and narrated by her younger brother over the course of a summer. And the younger brother is very confused and upset and concerned about what's going on with the person he's always believed to be his brother and is now his sister. And I published this book, you know, hoping that it was, you know, a work of, you know, compassion and empathy and understanding towards trans teenagers. And from the moment it came out, well, actually from about a week or two before it came out, it became a bit of a subject on Twitter, particularly, with a lot of criticism going towards the book. For various reasons. Most of the critics seemed to be saying that not only had they not read the book, but they wouldn't read the book, but it was still terrible. And sometimes those opinions veered from, because I'm not a trans person, so I shouldn't be writing the book, as if one should only write one's own experiences, or because the trans character was not the central character of the novel, which in my opinion was that, you know, I felt it was more appropriate for me to write from the perspective of the younger brother who is looking at the experience. The reality is, had I written it from the perspective of the trans character, I would have got criticized for that as well. So, you know, you can't win in such situations. And gender politics seems to be one which is very dominant on Twitter and on social media. And I came out of the experience feeling a bit beaten up, to be honest, because in all the years before that in publishing novels, you know, I'd had novels that were, you know, more popular, less popular, whatever, but I'd never really been the focus of so much anger or, you know, antipathy from people. And the way that complete strangers would sort of define your character online and say, you are this, you are a bigot, you are a transphobe, even though the book was supportive of trans people, so it didn't make huge amounts of sense. But I came away, as I say, feeling a bit beaten up by it. But then as time went on, asking myself, A, why do people feel the need to attack others online in that way? And why did it upset me so much that when it happened? So, you know, I would respond to people defending my work. And you have the right to defend your work. But, you know, is it worthwhile defending your work against people who are just deliberately misunderstanding it or not even reading it? So I wanted to understand for myself the mindset behind that. And I think if you're a writer, you know, as we are, then you try to understand it by writing a novel about it. So I came to it that way, saying, okay, I'm going to write a novel about social media, about what, like, why are we obsessed with it? Why do people use it? What do they get from it, particularly when they're using it in negative ways?
Okay, so then, so we now then arrive at the Cleverly family. What an extraordinary creation of people you've come up with here. We have George and Beverly, who are the parents, Nelson, Elizabeth, and Achilles, the children. Can you just do a kind of a little kind of pen portrait, a little kind of intro into the five Cleverlys that we have here?
Yeah, George is 60 years old, and he has worked for the BBC for decades. And you will have some experience of that, of course, and has interviewed everybody who's worth interviewing. So Beverly Cleverly is a romantic novelist who hires ghost writers to write her books for her. Nelson, the oldest child, is somebody who is very socially awkward, and he can only feel confident when wearing uniforms of jobs that he doesn't actually do, such as a police constable or a doctor. Elizabeth, the central daughter, the middle child, is a social media troll. All she's interested in is getting as many likes and followers as possible. And she trolls famous people, including her own father, and including at one point herself. And Achilles, the youngest, is basically just a sort of a 17-year-old brat who is very good-looking and uses gay social media sites to con older men into going out for dates with him and then blackmailing them. So they're all a little bit over the top, a little bit eccentric, and not always very likable.
No, that's true. I mean, occasionally it reminded me of Succession. You know, I don't know if have you watched Succession?
Yeah, I love Succession. Love it.
So that the Roy family, Logan, Kendall, and Robbie, you think they're all messed up. Well, you wait till you meet the Cleverleys. just on the subject of George, and then Matt and then Matt's in. So George is working for the BBC. Could you have set this in Ireland? Why was this a London book?
I always find that like London or New York are the kind of two kind of universal places, that if you set something in like Dublin or Paris or Rome, it has to be very specific to them. Whereas London, I think, can be kind of just universal to everybody. And I know London better than New York. So I often choose London for that reason as a setting for the book, if the particular setting is not so important.
Cool. Okay, Matt.
I love this book, John, and that won't come as any massive surprise, given I've loved so many of the other books that you've talked about when we've done this podcast and when we were at Radio 2 previously as well. And the first thing to say is that it's so funny. And I will say again, when we've had writers on with books that are funny, I make a point of saying, and that should be enough. Because often you find people say, yeah, the book's so funny, and it's also this, and it's also that. No, a book being funny is already clearing a bar that most supposedly funny books don't get close to clearing. So, the fact that it's funny is enough. The reason why it particularly chimed with me is, as I've already mentioned, I'm up in my loft at the moment, but downstairs, there is a picture. My wife bought me a sort of framed cartoon a couple of years ago. And this cartoon's from like the Victorian age. And basically, it's titled as London Club Men Parading for Practice in Writing to the Paper. In other words, they're literally queuing up in their club to be able to write a letter because they're so offended by something that they've read in the paper. And it is this seeking out offence that we obviously we see so much on social media, but. But I suppose the question that throws itself at me here is this not something that has always been there? Social media sort of exacerbates it, but there has always been this sort of latent desperation for relevance. I need to be relevant, therefore I'm going to seek out offence and find myself offended and find myself insulted so that I am relevant.
Yeah, I do think that a lot of people go onto social media hoping to have that voice that they have felt that is missing out in their lives, that they look at people on the radio or on television or in the papers and ask, why do they have a platform when I don't? And originally, I think when social media was set up, particularly when Twitter was set up, it had a lot of benefits to it. It amplified the voices of people who had been historically disenfranchised. It put everybody on the same level, effectively, whether you were the president of the United States or, a 16-year-old kid in school. And all you had to do, in a way, was be interesting. And then people would, you know, maybe come to you and listen to you. But I think in time as well that a lot of people decided to find their one subject and just pound away at it, you know, day after day after day, to an unhealthy extent. So whether that would be, in the case of where this book starts, gender politics, or, you know, it could be anything. It could be climate change. It could be, you know, what Donald Trump was doing for all those years, putting forward quite an unpleasant ideologies and so on. And just kind of sticking to that and becoming a voice within a movement about something. But I think you have to ask yourself whether that is real activism. And I'm not always sure that it is. You know, I always thought, like, when you look at something like the Black Lives Matter movement, and you saw people kind of marching across bridges and toppling statues into water, that seems to me to be actual activism. It's people actually doing things, going out on the street. Whereas sitting at home on your sofa and like tweeting away on your phone about something sometimes it feels like it's very performative, that it's about just getting people to react to you. But you're not actually, you're not getting out of the house. You're not really doing very much. So I don't know how useful that can be.
I had an image, John, of you writing this book and rubbing your hands with glee as you went from page to page and having an absolute blast writing it. I would quite like to see the unedited manuscript one day, just to see how much your esteemed editor said, are you sure about this bit in particular, John? But I certainly had an image of you. I mean, catharsis is maybe a ridiculous word to use, but that you were having an absolute ball writing this book.
I did have fun writing it, and I did have to reel myself in from time to time. And you mentioned my editor, you know, your editor, the same Bill, who, you know, one day I will show you if you like. And there was a lot of tone it down, you know, on certain pages. I think I had a lot of monologues at one point in it, you know, where people would just maybe 4 or 5 pages just ranting at the world. And Bill would say, you know, like, you've made your point. You can make it in one paragraph. You don't need 5 pages for it. But I did, I mean, I had fun writing it, mostly because, as well, I said to myself at the start, to pick up on what Matt was saying, that I wanted it to be funny. You know, I wanted to have as many jokes in it as possible. I felt if it wasn't funny, it would just seem like me being very thin-skinned or snarky about things, and that I had to have a sense of humor about this in order to write about it. I couldn't just feel that George was a terribly misunderstood man who, you know, life went more tragic for rather than comedic for. And, you know, you've read a lot of my books, I know, from our past discussions, and I don't write things which are funny that often. My books tend to be quite sad at times and quite emotional. And to completely change gear and try to get as many jokes in as possible, it's just good for the creative mind, I think, as much as anything else.
What can you, I don't, you might not want to say this, John, but what can you say in the book what the tipping point is? What is it that, just because it does refer specifically to our previous section of the conversation about your life, but what is it that George, the father of this family, what is it that he does which causes such offence and which causes everything to unravel?
Well, it's only the first thing that he does, because it then you know, becomes, you know, a whole spiral of unravelings. But it begins really with him having a conversation in his solicitor's office with his solicitor's secretary. And he is always being accustomed to meeting this young man, Aidan, behind that desk. And they've chatted many times over the years because, you know, George seems to get himself into enough trouble that he's often in his solicitor's office. And the secretary behind the desk, a young woman called Nadia, tells George that Aidan never existed. And George is dumbfounded by this, and he can't quite understand it because he's met this fellow so many times. Then later, his the solicitor informs him that in fact, that the secretary Nadia, which is Aidan reversed, Aidan has transitioned into being Nadia. And George didn't realize this. He didn't, you know, he just hadn't recognized it. You know, it just wasn't something he'd particularly known. And when he comes out, he sort of says it to the secretary, and he says, you know, rather than making me feel stupid and making me feel like, you know, I'm old and daft, you know, you could have just told me. We've always got along quite well. Is there any reason why, you know, it feels to me that, you know, because I'm this 60-year-old white man working for the BBC, you're assuming that I'm going to have some kind of prejudice towards you when I don't. And so, you know, they have this conversation. But when he goes out, he tweets a tweet of support for the secretary, but without thinking, he tweets it for Aidan rather than Nadia. He means well. His support is actually well-intentioned. But by misnaming or dead naming, I believe the word is, Nadia as Aiden, the forces of the internet come together and decide that he is the worst human being that's ever existed.
Right. And is, and again, this just maybe taps into your own experience, is the thing that he does that's even worse than that is he replies and responds and gets into a dialogue with his critics.
Yeah. And that is the ultimate mistake. There's no point doing that. And that's a mistake that I made back in the Jessica days. And, you know, you do have a right to defend your work. And if people are really saying some terrible things about you, it's very hard not to feel that I need to respond here. I need to say, look, the cartoon character that you're creating for me online bears no representation to me at all, other than sharing a name. But there's just nothing to be gained by it. They want to argue with you. They want to get your attention. They want you to be angry with them, like they're angry, actually not with you, with themselves, with the world. And you're just the focus of their anger on this particular day. So eventually I got to the point where I thought, you know, you can't answer these people anymore. It's just, it's pointless. And it was only causing me stress in my life because, you know, you might send a couple of replies and then you wake up the next morning and you think, oh my God, you know, what's going to be waiting for me when I open this app? Is it going to be a whole stream of abuse? And I would generally be quite polite with people. I would never be like rude or anything towards people. But you do get occasional people, and I had one in particular, who just become quite obsessive and stalky and frightening then at times as well. And if they use that voice often enough on the internet, well, you know, if somebody says, you know, every day for, you know, a year and a half, I know that Simon Mayo eats kittens. And, you know, roast them on his pizza oven.
Damn.
And eats them.
Damn.
You know, if somebody says this 3-4 times a day for 15 months, well, people start to believe it. And it's unfair. And I'm not in any way suggesting, Simon, that you eat kittens. But, but you know, if I said it every day, yes, somebody might listen to
me. And then the headline would be Simon Mayo denies that he eats kittens.
Denies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sorry, Matt. Yeah, so no. Well, it's always struck me there are two elements to social media being a concern, and John, you've already mentioned one being the sort of the interaction element of it. But if we take the sort of the premise of the book being that George tweets out something that is clumsy, and you know, as you say right at the start of the book, we all make mistakes. The difference with social media, as opposed to us all making mistakes 30 years ago, was when you made a mistake 30 years ago, that was it. You made the mistake, and maybe people pulled you up for it, and that was that. But with social media, it is always there. Unless you delete that tweet and delete that post, and by the way, you know, plenty of people choose to, you know, screenshot everything that you will post, and therefore it's not going to disappear. It's always going to be there, and that has become, you know, when I talk to sort of previous life, I would talk to athletes about how they deal with social media, and I was constantly saying to them, if you decide in the heat of competition, after you're really disappointed about something that you've, you know, about the way you've competed, you decide to go on social media, it is only going to end badly because your emotions are running and the next day you may regret what you've written, but it is always going to be there. And that's what people have to deal with now that they didn't have to deal with before social media. In other words, it's an aspect of social media that wasn't there previously. And, you know, we all did silly things, you know, in our teens or 20s, but at least those things haven't been preserved for forever.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is there's no room for nuance at all on social media, and especially on like 280 characters. There's no point trying to be witty or sarcastic or ironic in some way. Everything is taken out of context. And people who have, for whatever reason, taken against you are always looking for that one thing that you post, which they will say will define you. Now, the reality is if you were to follow me around all day from, you know, the moment I wake up till the moment I go to bed and just kind of record me, I'm going to say 20 stupid things. at least, you know, and that will just be before I've had my breakfast probably. And, but, you know, those stupid things are not necessarily things that have to define your character. They're just like a, you know, a stupid joke or a whatever it is. But as you say, Matt, because it's memorialized there and people will screenshot it and it will sort of, people will think this is what defines you. And it's a very silly way to look at people, I think.
There's a line in the book, John, I forget who says it, but it refers to Twitter as a place you can go to be awful. And I wonder if you think that Twitter is particularly it's particularly to blame, you know? And that's where Donald Trump was banned from first, I think. But there is something specifically about Twitter which is awful.
I think there is. Now, it's the one I have the most experience of because I wasn't on Facebook and or Snapchat or Instagram or anything like that. So it's the one I have the most experience of. I think there is a reason that Donald Trump chose it as his platform of choice. It does get to out there to a lot of people. And it feels like the most political of the social network platforms. Facebook was always, I think, about sort of connecting with friends in a way. Instagram always seemed to be sort of a kind place where you just sort of posted nice pictures of, you know, being on holiday or, you know, a nice pizza that you're eating, or a kitten for that matter. Twitter seems to be more engaged with, or people who have something more political to say, and political arguments, I mean, they're never going to end well anyway, really. Especially if it's done online, as opposed to, say, you know, two friends sitting in a pub talking about, you know, back in the good old days when people talked about Brexit, for example, two friends talking about it in a pub would probably have a very different conversation than two people talking about it online. Because I think we forget people's humanity online. We forget people's, that most people are basically kind and decent and they may have a different opinion to you on any particular subject, but it doesn't mean that they are the devil incarnate. I do find that Twitter is the one. Also, I think on Twitter, there's so many fake accounts and people feel emboldened by, you know, just making up a name, putting a sort of an anime display picture. I personally feel that, you know, it would be better if everybody had to sign up for anybody who signed up for an account had to do it with their actual real details, like, you know, passport or something, to so that you actually had to stand by the things that you say. I mean, like, when I look back and, you know, if I'm responding to somebody who isn't a real, like, has a stupid name and a stupid picture, has zero followers and, you know, follows two people, and I'm getting into a debate with them, I mean, I have to ask myself, why am I wasting my time? You know, as opposed to a Nobel Prize winning writer was to tweet me or something, at least I'd be engaged with somebody who is in my sort of industry. But, you know, responding to people with fake profiles seems a bit pointless. So I think it would be a healthier environment if, by the nature of it, you had to really stand by your words.
And you're off Twitter at the moment, John. I was trying to find you on Twitter because I was posting how much I was enjoying the book and so on, and I was trying to at you and then realized that you weren't there. So is that all part of this process, the fact you're not?
I felt just as I went off for just about 2 or 3 weeks before the book is coming out, and I'll stay off for about 4 or 5 weeks after. It's just kind of like a couple of months break. It feels like a sensible detox when a book comes out, because I felt particularly with this book and with the themes of this book that, well, two things. I thought, you know, that I would potentially have a lot of people shouting at me again, which, you know, I don't really want to wake up to. And also it did seem a little bit silly for me to be, you know, ranting on about how awful social media is and then tweeting about it. So I thought I'll take a few months off, and then in a couple of months' time, I'll just see how I feel. Maybe I'll, because I mean, there are positives to it. Like, I'm not saying it's all terrible. I mean, one of the things that I generally use Twitter for is like what you just described. You know, you're reading a book and you say, I really like this book. And actually, I think that's that goes further these days than a quote on the front of a jacket. I think if you're reading something that you really enjoy and you say why, and it's an unsolicited quote as such. I think that that reaches a lot more readers, and it does better for writers and publishers and so on. So I enjoy, I mean, they are the parts that I enjoy on Twitter. Connecting with writers, connecting with readers, and being able to talk about books that I like, which is for the most part what I do. And I think that's a healthy way to use it.
I have a sort of theory about social media. And so the only social media I'm on is, or the only one I use regularly, is Twitter. I've never been on Facebook. And that is, so we tend to forget, when Twitter first started out, and certainly for the first couple of years, I know, Simon, you were on Twitter well before I was on Twitter. And when it first started out, it was bluntly a lot of celebrities. And there was what I would call the Stephen Fry and Lyft years, which was, you know, Stephen Fry, I'm stuck in a Lyft and the Lyft's not going anywhere. And I'm tweeting out to my followers and you know, what can we do in this Lyft while we're stuck here? And he was getting all these fun things coming into him. Can you imagine that now? Celebrity stuck in a Lyft. What should I do? Basically, Twitter is going to be alive with people saying, throw yourself down the shaft. I've had enough of you in your Lyft. And so Twitter went from this being this place where everyone was like, oh, I can contact, you know, Stephen Fry, Simon Mayo, I can talk to them, whereas I wouldn't have been able to do it before. And to begin with, it was all great. It's like being this sort of massive marquee where the first people in the marquee are all very polite. And then this other wave of people come in who've all had a beer and have decided, you know what, it's all a little bit saccharine in here. I'm going to say what I think. And I'm going to tell these celebrities exactly what I think of them because that's, you know, that's going to be my thing. And so then, as I say, Twitter got a little bit sort of, you know, dodgy. So everyone started saying, right, I'm now going to Instagram where it's much nicer. And Instagram was nicer for a couple of years. And then everyone talked about how, you know, people keep sliding into my DMs on Instagram and saying really unpleasant things. This is a long-winded way of me saying there is something at the heart of social media, which means it's going to turn. As much as we, you know, it might start off with the most noble of aims, and I would agree with you, John, with this idea of, you know, everyone has to, you know, give a sort of snapshot of your passport, that kind of thing. I can't believe that Zuckerberg or, you know, Jack at Twitter, that they set off with the idea, I'm going to create this social media monster. I think there were noble aims at the start of it, but when you add that the algorithm of social media to the algorithm of human beings, it's just going to turn, and it's always going to turn at some point.
Yeah, I agree that there were noble aims, and I think there are still noble aims on it at times, and many people use it in positive ways. But as you say, there are controversialists, people who will maybe try to build a media profile, and they don't even half the time believe the things they're saying themselves. They're just saying things just to get attention, and, you know, just to kind of, you know, to sort of, I know she's not on it anymore, but the sort of Katie Hopkins type people of the world who see this is the way I can make a career is by just being nasty. And every so often something tragic happens. You know, we saw it when Caroline Flack died. Something tragic happens and everybody says we now need to kind of be more considerate of each other, or hashtag be kind on social media. And it seems to last for about 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And before it all changes. I remember, like, it's an awful thing to say, but it's the truth. I remember when Caroline Flack died, seeing a very prominent UK broadcaster saying how awful it was, how, you know, this should never be allowed to happen again. She was too young, the abuse. And then 20 minutes later, tweeting another tweet about Jane Fonda and criticizing her for having work done on her face and for having, you know, political opinions within 20 minutes. And, you know, you think, do you not see it? Do you not see that, like, 1 minute you're looking for likes by saying it's terrible, and then you're slagging off an 80-year-old woman for no reason? The disconnect there, Piers Morgan, was huge. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people listening, John, will be nodding, thinking, yep, this is exactly what I was thinking. And that anonymity point, I remember talking to Mark Kermode, who I do the film show with on Five Lives, also the film critic for The Observer, and he was looking at the, you know, below the line comments, and I kept on telling him to stop because because it doesn't matter how erudite the publication is, as soon as you go to the below the line comments, it's rancid. You know, it's absolutely terrible, and I'm sure your suggestion of anonymity would help. I can't see it's going to happen anytime soon, though.
And also the thing is, you could read 100 comments about your film show, for example, and 99 of them could say very nice things. And it's that one comment that says something horrible that sticks with you. And that, you know, you could just be having a bad day. You could be, you know, you could be in a bad mood. You could be feeling ill. There could be something going on in your life. And that one comment that somebody sends just to be mean can really destroy your day or push you in all sorts of unhealthy directions.
Right at the beginning of the conversation, John, you said that you wanted to explore social media. And one of the things that you wanted to explore in this book is why you had been so upset by the reaction to the Jessica book. Did you come to any, I mean, apart from the obvious, did you come to any conclusions about why you were particularly traumatized in the way you were?
I did. And I think it comes down to bullying. And I think when I was in school, I was not a very confident child. I wasn't particularly bullied, I have to say. I was more sort of one of those that isn't particularly noticed. But I look back at my school days as being, you know, years of being a sort of heightened anxiety every day, you know, keeping always on edge in case something was to happen or I was to say the wrong thing or, you know, catch the wrong person's eye and something traumatic could happen. And I felt very much that the social media experience was about bullying. And no matter whether you're a 12-year-old or a 90-year-old, bullying is an appalling thing and can really, really affect a person. And I guess it took me back to feeling like that.
And where do you go from here, John? Do you have you got this out of, have you, having rubbed your hands with glee and enjoyed yourself creating this monster family, what do we get from you next? I'm sure you have at least half a dozen projects on the go.
I do have it out of my system. That's true. I've you know, that's my last sort of social media commentary. So yeah, I'm working on the next book as I always am, and I was working on it there, you know, this morning before we started talking. And I tried to get into screenwriting during lockdown, and I've done a bit of that, and haven't yet got something, you know, commissioned. So it could be a complete failure on my part, but at least you know, I just decided to try something different, and I turned 50, so I wanted to kind of set myself a new challenge, and I got commissioned to adapt someone else's novel for a feature. So we'll see, does that come to something? And I've quite enjoyed that. So yeah, I mean, lots of projects on the go, but mostly the same kind of, you know, always just working on the new book. I still feel as excited about new books as I ever did.
John Boyton, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us today.
Thanks, Simon.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.